This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, a vaccine supply stoush. The Victorian Premier decries as totally unfair allocations to New South Wales. Also, proof of vaccination is an emerging global issue, and in New South Wales, police are set to start checking on people out picnicking.
People are still coming to terms with QR codes. We've got a lot of elderly people, people from culturally diverse backgrounds. You know, they won't have the app. Maybe they won't install the app. What do we do with them? It'll be a logistical nightmare. We can't have police in every park in New South Wales, and we have 586 parks in our city alone.
And the Prime Minister's defence of a trip back and forth from Sydney to Canberra, while most ordinary citizens are locked down. Welcome to the program. A major stoush has erupted between the states and the Commonwealth over the allocation of precious doses of the Pfizer vaccine. An irate Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, has seized on analysis by the ABC's 7:30 program, which suggests New South Wales has been given hundreds of thousands of doses which should have gone into Victorian arms. He's accusing the federal government of entering into secret arrangements, a claim both the Prime Minister and the Health Minister deny. Samantha Donovan reports.
The Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews says he's been wondering why his state's vaccination rates have been lagging behind those of New South Wales. And he says analysis by the ABC's 7:30 program aired last night has given him the explanation. Here's 7:30's chief political correspondent, Laura Tingle.
Back in late June, as Sydney's current outbreak was just taking off, New South Wales was receiving 32% of the national Pfizer allocation through primary care, mostly GPs. But by last month, its allocation had jumped to 45%. Based on these numbers, for example, it appears Victoria may have missed out on up to 343,000 Pfizer jabs between June and September, Queensland 100,000 jabs, and Western Australia 114,000 jabs.
Mr. Andrews says he and the Victorian public have good reason to be angry.
I signed up to a national plan to vaccinate our nation, not a national plan to vaccinate Sydney. This was done without anyone knowing, and the Commonwealth have got caught doing it.
He emphasised he doesn't begrudge New South Wales getting the extra allocations that were declared, but his problem is with what he calls secret arrangements.
What I didn't know was that Premier Berejiklian's in a sprint while the rest of us are supposed to do some sort of egg and spoon thing. No, we want our fair share. These allocations, which are totally unfair and were under the table, need to stop, and we need to get a make good. We need to get those doses that we didn't get fast-tracked to us.
In a statement to the ABC's 7:30 program, a spokesman for Operation COVID Shield, which is led by Lieutenant General John Frewen, said part of the response to the New South Wales outbreak in July and August had involved rapidly bringing 260 GP practices in New South Wales into the rollout. And that's what Daniel Andrews says he has a problem with.
General Frewen has confirmed last night that what's happened is that they had extra points of presence, as they call them, and it wasn't like, well, here's the national pool, you're going to have more points of presence, but you have to share your share amongst a greater number of spots. No, each and every one of the increased spots were fully allocated. The Polish doses do not account for this.
The Prime Minister denies Pfizer vaccines are being unfairly allocated among the states and territories to benefit New South Wales. But Scott Morrison has told Sky News he rejected requests from New South Wales to take vaccines from other states and sought doses overseas to bolster that state's supply.
And the argument was being put forward that New South Wales should take doses from other states. Well, I tell you who said no to that. It was me. Because I wasn't going to have doses moved from other states to New South Wales. I went out and got more doses from Poland.
This afternoon, the Health Minister, Greg Hunt, announced that over the next week, 1.7 million Pfizer doses from Singapore and the UK will be distributed to the states and territories on a per capita basis. He was asked about Daniel Andrews' comments that secret arrangements have seen New South Wales get more vaccines than the other states.
As we've had outbreaks, we've prioritised those areas to save lives. In particular, we started by prioritising Victoria when there was the Victorian outbreak. Indeed, the Victorian state system has received a higher per capita rate of doses delivered than New South Wales.
Western Australia and Queensland are also critical of the way the Commonwealth has been allocating vaccines. The West Australian Premier, Mark McGowan, wants more sent to his state.
We can't have a situation where you're penalised when you give your doses to New South Wales and you don't get a proper full catch-up.
Queensland's Health Minister Yvette Darth says the Commonwealth needs to stop criticising the states because their own data shows Queensland is using its supply.
We knew New South Wales were getting more than us, but not realising that it was actually being taken away from us, so we're getting less per capita now.
On Queensland and WA's concerns, the Health Minister Greg Hunt had this to say.
We know in relation to Western Australia, they're doing a great job. But there's still 150,000 unordered doses in WA and 394,000 unordered doses in Queensland. And so they were available and those states could have drawn on them.
Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt, Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, the people of the tiny outback New South Wales town of Wilcannia, where COVID is raging, today had the ear of the state's Health Minister Brad Hazzard, who made a personal visit. More than 13% of the population in the isolated town have caught the virus, one of a clutch of largely Indigenous communities in the state now struggling with infections. First Nations leaders in Wilcannia fronted the minister, saying they need solutions to long-term problems, not just COVID problems. Carly Williams prepared this report with Lucy Thackray.
Red dirt, one supermarket and 2 hours to the next town. When the COVID-ravaged town of Wilcannia hears that help is on the way, it can feel like slow motion.
It's been a bit, you know, slow because we're in Western New South Wales. Nothing comes out here very fast. It's not like, you know, we're living in Sydney where it's next day postage. We've got to wait a week, sometimes 2 weeks, just to get something really important like, you know, medication or...
That's Christopher McHughes. Locals call him Burra. He's the crew leader with the Briwarrina Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Rural Fire Service, who've set up in Wilcannia to help with the disaster relief. The town has a prominent Indigenous community, the Barkindjee people, and is one of the hardest Delta-hit areas in the country. There's more than 100 cases in a population that hovers between 550 to 700. They've recently seen an influx of 100 defence personnel, which has proved a challenge.
You know, especially with these smaller Western New South Wales communities, you need a, you know, relationship with the communities, with everyone in the community. And I believe that, you know, there's a fail between, you know, the local government and Aboriginal, especially Aboriginal communities. I feel there's no connection or, you know, there's no, you know, interactions.
New South Wales Health Minister Brad Hazzard is in Wilcannia today, almost 4 weeks into the outbreak.
Yeah, let me say this, that I've never been reluctant to get involved in discussing issues with the community. That's how politicians learn. And as far as I'm concerned, I've made a decision, which is to be on the ground and to hear what people's concerns are. It's already been extremely valuable. The meetings I've had in Dubbo, the discussions I've had already here with the medical staff at Wilcannia MPS Hospital have been very valuable. So it's well worth it.
A fleet of 30 motorhomes arrived in Wilcannia over the weekend so that people who have contracted the virus can safely isolate. Central Darling Shire Council General Manager Greg Hill says the campervans are due to begin housing residents from today.
At the moment, it's important that we've got somewhere for people to isolate, and that's an ideal spot. It's a good setup now with the vans there and with the amenities they put in place. I think people will be comfortable for 14 days there, so and well looked after.
As for Burra, he wants the spotlight on Wilcannia and surrounding areas to help solve the long-term problems.
You know, when COVID's settled down a little bit and travel restrictions back in place, we need, you know, the people to come out and, you know, experience how we live out here. You know, it's majorly differently than living in, you know, even Dubbo or Orange, you know, where they got the Maccas or a fully functional ED, or just, you know, be kind to the Western New South Wales people.
Christopher Burra McHughes, Lucy Thackray and Carly Williams with that report. Well, gripped by its continuing COVID outbreak, New South Wales is also continuing to make headway with vaccinations. And the state's leaders are repeating their rather blunt message. Those who are not double dosed will miss out on some of the freedoms granted when the state begins to ease lockdowns. Police will begin checking for proof of full vaccinations next week where it's required. But will everyone find it easy to provide that proof? David Sparks has more.
For a while now, the New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, has been promising special treats for people who have had two doses of a COVID vaccine. Well under half of her state's eligible population has hit that mark so far, but she's happy with the number of people who have had at least one dose.
In some of our hotspot local government areas, the first dose average is just amazing. Blacktown is over 85% first dose, Camden's over 86%, Campbelltown's over 82%, Parramatta's over 81%, Canberra-Bankstown's over 76% and Dubbo's over 77%. And of course our message is don't be left behind, because when we open up at 70% double dose, it will be only for those who are vaccinated.
New South Wales reported 1,220 new COVID cases today, along with 8 more deaths. The Premier hopes that threat of being left behind will drive more people toward vaccination. From next Monday, double-dosed people will be allowed to spend more time outdoors, to varying degrees depending on which council they're in. That means picnics are back on the agenda. But to do that, you'll have to carry proof.
So you'll have the ability to download your app from Medicare, immunisation records, which we all have. Anyone that's been vaccinated will have that, and on your MyGov app. So that's the proof, or you've got to be able to prove that you got vaccinated. That's actually part of the conditions of having those freedoms, that you've got to be able to prove if you are pulled up by police.
Deputy Premier John Barilaro says for now that proof will be the vaccination certificate downloaded on the Commonwealth's MyGov app. He says eventually a vaccination passport will operate on the Service New South Wales app. What he didn't point out is that people who can't get proof of vaccination online can call the Australian Immunisation Register to get a paper version of their immunisation history posted to them. Interpreters are available. But there's still concern about fairness given the focus on the smartphone app. Cal Asfour is Mayor of Canterbury-Bankstown in southwest Sydney.
Look, double-dose vaccinations are definitely an incentive for more freedoms, and that's the carrot the New South Wales government's been dangling at us at the moment. But I just think, nobody should be left behind. I think there needs to be a fairness and an equity for everybody. And I think sometimes some of these restrictions, like the curfew we've had in place, when there's no evidence of it working, and we have the Deputy Premier even saying it doesn't work. So we're just going to make sure that there's fairness and equity in all decisions that are being made by government.
So next week, it's actually when the new freedoms come in. In your case, in this council area, it's an extra hour of recreation if you double dosed outside. And police are going to be checking for proof of that you're double dosed. Like if someone's having a picnic. Are you comfortable with the police doing that?
Look, I see what the government's doing here, and I understand why they're going ahead with this, but having the police checking vaccine passports while you're sitting at a park with your kids just doesn't sit right with me. We've been told we can exercise outdoors for unlimited periods. I think people in the community aren't going to take too kindly to being asked to produce credentials while they're sitting on a picnic blanket having some chicken and chips or fish and chips with their kids. And I just don't know if there's been any health evidence to say that sitting outdoors is a COVID-spreading event. I also want to just make sure that they always think about fairness and equity. We've seen people on Bondi Beach now for months not wearing masks. Are they being checked? Are we going to see the extra policing, in Bondi and on the beaches and in the eastern suburbs as well, as we've had here for the last, nearly a month? I just think that when the government comes out with things like this, it makes it logistically impossible for it to be done in a fair and equitable way. And that's what concerns me about it.
Meanwhile, there's growing anxiety about the expected increase in demand for intensive care beds and staff in October. Government modelling shows that's when hospitalisations will hit their peak. Nurses across New South Wales have signed a letter calling for more staff in ICUs. The Nurses and Midwives Association General Secretary Brett Holmes wants more information about the government's planning.
We are seeking further clarification of where all of the additional nurses are going to come from and whether they've had the opportunity to brush up their skills and be properly supported if they're going to be standing at the bedside of COVID patients who need ventilation.
That report from David Sparks. Well, 70 and 80%, they are the magic numbers. We're being promised that once 70% of the eligible population is fully vaccinated, we'll be afforded some freedoms. At 80%, there'll be even more. But there are still pockets of vaccine hesitancy, including some celebrities shying away from promoting the jab. Pop singer Guy Sebastian's inhabiting a world of backlash at the moment for downplaying his involvement in a music industry social media campaign that's urging Australians to get vaccinated.
The campaign was posted to my page without my direct involvement. And whilst I, like everybody else in my industry, I want things to get going again, it is not my role to communicate in the way that that post was communicating. I would never, ever tell people what to do when it comes to their personal health choices. I'm very sensitive of it, not only on a public level, but even in my personal life with people who have circumstances that they have to consider when making these choices. So I just want to say I'm really sorry.
Well, with or without celebrity help, what happens if vaccination rates fall short? Bridget Fitzgerald takes a look.
It's an enticing view of the future. We're being told that once 70% of the eligible population is vaccinated, life can start to return to normal.
The next stage will be triggered when 70% of the population is vaccinated.
We take another big step if and when 80% of us are vaccinated.
Once you get to 70% and 80%, the plan sets out that we have to move forward.
Australian leaders expect we'll hit those levels in the next few months. But overseas, some jurisdictions are struggling. In the US state of Wyoming, half of the population doesn't want a COVID vaccine.
We had about 50-50. So 50% said they would take the vaccine and 50% said that they would not take the vaccine.
Madison Ashworth is a PhD student in behavioural and health economics and part of a team at the University of Wyoming studying vaccine hesitancy. Wyoming's got one of the lowest COVID immunisation rates in the country. Just 39% of people there are fully vaccinated. 45% have had a single dose. But it's looking like it won't get much higher than that.
We found in our national sample, when we looked at the US as a whole, that the personal health benefit information message had a pretty significant impact on vaccine intention. So it increased the vaccination rate from, I think it was 49% in the control group that got no information, to 65%. So it was a pretty significant increase. But when we looked at that same study, we ran the same study for a subset of Wyoming residents, no information message had any effect.
Wyoming's a mostly rural state with a conservative population that's distrustful of the government. It also hasn't seen large COVID outbreaks. Here in Australia, around 20% of people aged 16 and over are estimated to be vaccine hesitant. That includes those unwilling to get it at all and the unconvinced.
And we're not sure whether yet what it's going to bottom out at. Interestingly, in the last month or so, New South Wales, it was coming down and then it's kind of just plateaued and stopped falling.
Professor Anthony Scott's a health economist at the Melbourne Institute at the University of Melbourne. He's collecting data on the subject. Every fortnight, 1,200 randomly selected Australians are surveyed about their vaccine hesitancy.
Vaccine hesitancy is about 20% now, you know, so that if we reach 80, then that could be possible. You know, if the proportion of unsure people fall a bit, then there we might exceed that.
But we'll need more of an emphasis on pushing those uncertain people over the line.
Yeah. It's going to get harder and it's going to take longer as we approach that. But I think it requires a big effort and we need to use all the policies that we can.
Hesitancy is more of a problem in Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia, where around 22 to 23% of people 16 years and over are unwilling to get the jab or are unconvinced. If things don't change there, those states won't reach the 80% of those eligible vaccination target that National Cabinet signalled would end most of the lockdowns, which means state borders could stay closed for longer.
What I think we're missing in states like Western Australia and other states is that the pandemic actually hasn't come here yet.
Dr. Katie Atwell is a vaccination policy expert at the University of Western Australia. The University of Melbourne survey shows hesitancy in New South Wales is running at just 18%, the lowest in Australia. Dr. Atwell says in states where COVID risk seems low, mandates and incentives are the best way to increase uptake.
Look, it will get some people over the line because it will get those people over the line who are waiting for a reason. So if they're not outright opposed to having the vaccine, but they're waiting for something to make it come across their desk or come across their front door right now as something that they want to do, it can be effective in those people. What we know already in terms of workplace vaccine mandates, we know that when people are required to vaccinate, whether for COVID-19 or previously, for example, for flu, there will be some people who are hold up who say, right, that's it, that's me done in this workforce. But most people do comply.
Back in Wyoming, researcher Madison Ashworth is hopeful a little over half of the population will end up vaccinated. But it won't be enough, which means it's likely the state will have to keep some restrictions in place indefinitely to protect the unvaccinated.
I don't think that 50 to 60% is going to get us that herd immunity number, no.
Madison Ashworth from the University of Wyoming, Bridget Fitzgerald with that report. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, why more than 1 million Australians who are ready and willing to work are not looking for a job anymore. Well, amid mounting criticism, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison has defended taking a return trip from Canberra to Sydney for the Father's Day weekend. With both the ACT and New South Wales in lockdown and thousands of families separated by COVID-19 restrictions, former opposition leader Bill Shorten accused Mr Morrison of double standards and exercising appalling judgment. The PM concedes he can understand why people feel frustrated, but called some of the criticism directed at him a cheap shot. From Canberra, here's political reporter James Glenday.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister. Appreciate your time today.
With a storm on social media and faced with a growing number of reports that questioned his recent travel, Scott Morrison went on Sky News to explain why he spent the weekend in Sydney.
I can understand people's frustration, but I do think that there has been a lot of misinformation about this.
It's unclear what he's referring to because the circumstances surrounding his trip seem simple. He flew to his home city on Friday for the Father's Day weekend before returning to Canberra on Monday morning. He then took part in the virtual National Summit on Women's Safety, and his office says he held a meeting related to national security.
I often have to be here for work. There was no exemption required for me to return home, as I do on any occasion that I do have that opportunity. The exemption I require is to come back here to the ACT.
And he got that exemption, like most politicians do, because they are considered essential workers, critical to the functioning of the country, though he has to follow some extra COVID safety protocols while in Canberra. The ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr confirmed Mr Morrison met all the requirements.
This is the nation's capital. It is the heart of Australian democracy, and so it does need to be able to function. But situations like this, I understand, cause concern, and it's not really a particularly good look.
And the Prime Minister's critics say that is the problem. They say it's the optics, not the action itself. On a Father's Day, when many people were separated from loved ones by lockdowns and closed domestic and international borders, Mr Morrison got to see his wife and children by travelling between two lockdown cities. Former opposition leader Bill Shorten was particularly critical.
I think Mr Morrison has exercised poor judgment in this case. I was a bit surprised when I read he had done this, to be honest. It's not that he doesn't deserve to see his kids, but so does every other Australian. And I think that when your people are doing it tough, you've got to do it tough too.
Many of Mr Morrison's opponents liken this visit to the Hawaii holiday the Prime Minister took during the bushfires in 2019, and the story has been spread about by some Labor staff. They claim he lacks judgment and claim it's the sort of thing that will resonate with lockdown families, some of whom already believe the Morrison government's slow vaccine rollout is at least partly to blame for their current predicaments. The PM today tried to dismiss Mr Shorten's criticisms as all a bit unfair.
Bill knows that the Prime Minister needs to go backward and forwards between these places to do the work. He understands that secure documents, secure discussions that need to be held. So he knows all of that. And so, frankly, it's a bit of a cheap shot.
There are, of course, plenty more perks to being Prime Minister than essential worker status, like having many staff, an aeroplane, and being given the choice of two mansions, one in Canberra and one on the harbour in Sydney. Although our nation's leaders like to believe they're in touch with the average person, they don't really live like them day to day, and for the most part, Australians accept and understand this. But generally, voters are less tolerant of Prime Ministers who appear shifty. Scott Morrison might have snuffed out this story straight away had he simply been upfront, explained why he was travelling and done more of his work and meetings remotely from his Sydney residence. If there's one thing families are sympathetic to during this pandemic, it's the enormous challenge of juggling work and parenting responsibilities.
Indeed it is. Political reporter James Glenday there. Well, there's been a persistent worrying trend at the heart of Australia's jobs market, which is the number of people who've dropped out of the system, who could work, are perfectly capable of doing so, but are just no longer looking for a job. Well, now the Bureau of Statistics has dug deeper into the figures and put some firm numbers together, and they have come up with the number of more than a million people who are in that category. Business reporter David Taylor takes a look.
54-year-old Pauline juggles part-time work and looking after her two children with disability. Her eldest has autism.
So Nicholas is 33 and my daughter Tabitha, she's 10 and she's actually been diagnosed with major anxiety and she's actually on medication for anxiety and is homeschooled.
She's on JobSeeker, but she desperately wants more work because it's a struggle paying for life's essentials.
Look, it's even just the basics. It's rent, trying to make sure that I can power, have a phone, internet. I've got children, so they need it for school as well as for looking for jobs.
The ABS has released data showing in February, 2.2 million people were not employed but did want to work. Of these 2.2 million people, roughly 800,000 were actively looking for work and counted as unemployed. But more than a million were not looking for work.
The official unemployment rate is really just the tip of the iceberg. And underneath that iceberg is a great chasm of people falling behind in the labour market that's failing to put them into jobs.
Alison Pennington is a senior economist with the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work. She says these figures expose how little the official unemployment rate, which is reported every month by the ABS, tells us about the state of the jobs market.
Then you add in these marginally attached workers and realistic unemployment is far closer to like nearly 3 million. It's 20 to 30%.
So why would someone who wants work not look for work? Alison Pennington says for many women, caring for children is the biggest hurdle to finding work.
The very prohibitive cost of childcare, we know, are holding back thousands of women from getting into the workforce.
Many graduates aren't in search of a job either. Alison Pennington says it takes, on average, more than 2.5 years for a graduate to land a full-time role. But perhaps a more disturbing trend is the number of job candidates who give up on their career after being unemployed for an extended period of time. Peter Davidson is the principal advisor at the Australian Council of Social Service.
Can you imagine applying for 20 jobs a month for a year or more?
He says if job seekers don't find work in the first 3 months of trying, their chances drop significantly every 6 months thereafter until, after a year, it falls away by 50%. Equity economics lead economist Angela Jackson argues the welfare system hinders the job search for many.
And our current system effectively does that. It effectively says to people, you're out of work, okay, you know, here you go, have some poverty, see how you go with that on top of looking for work. And it just makes it harder.
Job seeker Pauline says finding the money and the time to look for work is an enormous struggle every month.
I've got to look at like making sure that I can fit in an interview time that suits when they can be looked after and that they're fine when I go for an interview, and even having the money for the petrol to get to an interview and just making sure I've got a decent outfit and clothes to wear.
We asked the Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, to respond to criticisms that unemployment benefits were too low to assist in finding work. In a statement, he said, quote, earlier this year, at a cost of $9 billion, the government made the single largest year-on-year increase to the rate of unemployment benefits since 1996. But Alison Pennington says the sheer number of people out of work who want work point to some fundamental problems.
We have, you know, over a million people sitting on the economic sidelines of the economy who want to participate, but cannot.
Job seeker Pauline wants a job as a social worker, and she wants to earn enough so that she doesn't stress about paying rent every month.
And me, I'd like to do something where I help people.
Job seeker and mum of two, Pauline. David Taylor, our reporter there. And that is PM for this Tuesday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. You can hear us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to the podcast. And check out another news podcast. It's called The Signal, each weekday morning.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.